Well, only after government pressure on the tobacco industry increased did we learn how big a fight Big Tobacco put up. The release of volumes of documents from the industry revealed how hard it worked to twist the science and influence public opinion, which kept people smoking for years. Has anybody else used this strategy? Well, yeah. The food industry, says Kristen Kearns. She's an assistant professor in dental public health at the University of California, San Francisco, and joins us on The Exchange this morning. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So your report and this archive of documents showed up from the food industry at UCSF. Where did those documents come from?
Well, it actually came from me digging into library archives. So I had an experience actually while living in Portland, Oregon, where I was attending a dental conference way back in 2007. And I heard from two keynote speakers talking about the links between gum disease and diabetes. And neither one of them were talking about the role of sugar in diabetes. In fact, I had gotten a government brochure from our National Diabetes Education Program that had diet advice that said nothing about sugar. And another speaker told me that there was no evidence linking sugar to chronic disease. And as a dentist, I found that extremely surprising because obviously the role of sugar in tooth decay is significant. And so I started to wonder whether there had been some sort of influence over what government officials were saying about sugar. And I had been reading books by Marion Nestle, who had written a book called Food Politics and had talked about how the sugar industry had influenced some of our past dietary guidelines. And so I just got curious, and I would go home after work and start looking on the internet trying to learn about who is the sugar industry and who their trade groups are, and started to find that there was some material in public libraries. And I actually had moved back to Colorado in the midst of this and was at my local Denver Public Library picking up some books I had found on the sugar industry and typed in sugar to the local library catalog and found the records of the Great Western Sugar Company, which, based in Denver, had grown sugar beets going back to the early 1900s even, and they went out of business in the late 1970s. And when they did, they decided to donate some of their records to local libraries, which had most to do with agricultural history, some labor history, but just a few boxes on nutrition policy slipped through their lawyer's screening and ended up at the Colorado State University Library. And I just happened to be the first one to go up and take a look at them. And the first document I found was a confidential memo from the Sugar Association, which is a trade group based in Washington, D.C. And it was confidential, and I had discovered this trove of documents from a time in the 1970s when sugar was really being scrutinized by the Food and Drug Administration, who was considering heavily regulating sugar, and I had found their public relations campaign on how they set out to influence the FDA. And from there, I kept getting clues about other groups, other consultants, and was able to find many more public archives just out there across the country, which we've now been able to collect and partner with other libraries to start digitizing this material and put them online. And so we've just launched this online archive here at UCSF last month with all of those documents.
So, and I understand that some additional documents have actually gotten dumped by Russian hackers. How did that happen?
That's right. So while we had this project going on looking at these public archives, the Hillary Clinton email scandal was occurring, and part of the WikiLeaks documents that were released, which they were called the DC Leaks documents, happened to have some material about the food industry in there as well. So I think it was one of Hillary Clinton's staffers had been also consulting for Coca-Cola. And so there was some correspondence going back and forth with Coca-Cola about some of their strategies to oppose soda taxes, for example. And so we actually have some contemporary documents stemming from that material. As well, there is some material from some nonprofit organizations and journalists who have done freedom of information requests at public universities, where there have been some researchers that have been taking money from groups like Coca-Cola and the American Beverage Association. And so we have some more current material from those sources as well.
Kristen Kearns is our guest this morning on the Jefferson Exchange. She's an assistant professor in dental public health at the University of California in San Francisco. So are there serious food-related health concerns that are buried in these documents? I'm thinking, for example, of I'm not sure that this is specifically addressed in this documents, but, you know, recently there's been some surprising research that showed that diet soda, which contains no sugar, has a direct link to obesity. So what are some of the things that you found in these documents that may have been buried over the years?
Well, the diet soda issue is interesting because the sugar industry has an interest in artificial sweeteners not being successful. So the sweeteners in diet sodas. And so the sugar industry has actually funded quite a bit of research on artificial sweeteners to try to say that they're not effective or they're not safe. So I found that to be fascinating. But as far as the health effects of sugar, we've been able to find some material that dating back to the 1960s, the sugar industry was doing research to help them understand sugar's role in heart disease. And in one particular study, it was an animal study, they were looking at what happens when you have bacteria in the gut versus when you don't have bacteria in the gut. And they were realizing there was this link between bacteria and triglyceride levels in the blood and heart disease. They actually found that when they were comparing rats eating sugar versus rats eating starch, that the rats eating sugar had this elevated biomarker, this elevated enzyme that was at the time related to bladder cancer. So we actually published this study showing that the sugar industry had done this work, kind of proved to themselves internally that sugar had very specific metabolic effects, that it had this link to this enzyme, and then they ended up pulling the funding for the study, and the results were never published. And so we had a paper come out detailing that incident. And then other work that they have done is really trying to cast doubt on the links between sugar and heart disease in particular. I think that back in the 1960s, the way the evidence was emerging was that we were all just a little bit different in how we respond to different diets, and some people are very sensitive to sugar, and eating that sugar would lead to an elevated triglyceride level in the blood, and they were really trying to minimize the importance of that evidence. And they did lots of things that the tobacco industry did. They reached out to Harvard scientists and paid them to write a very critical and biased review of the evidence that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, did not disclose that the sugar industry had funded that review. Those Harvard scientists went on to be very influential in setting dietary policy.
This is the study. Sorry, I just wanted to step in here. This is the study where they really shifted the blame to fat and cholesterol as the major players in coronary disease, correct, versus sugar?
That's right. So they were looking at both sides of the story. They were comparing the evidence linking saturated fat to heart disease to the evidence linking sugar to heart disease, and they were overly critical of the evidence linking sugar to heart disease, and they were very lenient in their criticism of the evidence linking saturated fat to heart disease. So we found that it was a very biased review of the evidence.
Kristen Kearns is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor in dental public health at the University of California, San Francisco, talking about a new archive of documents showing the operations of the food industry. So many years ago, Big Tobacco actually started buying up food producers. How do you interpret that strategy?
Well, that's right. When they were in the midst of all the litigation and realizing that sales, of course, were going to be going down of their main products, they looked at diversifying into into food. And so Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds started buying up food companies, Kraft, General Foods, for example, and started applying their knowledge of how to promote cigarettes to how to promote products such as sugary beverages targeted towards children and other products. So there's a lot of parallels between the two industries. And not only that, but the tobacco industry has owned food industry companies.
So can you give us some examples of some of the other ways that this document archive shows the big food industry and sugar producers, for example, taking pages from the tobacco industry? I mean, we talked about influencing science. Are there other things showing up in the archive that you're concerned about?
Well, another example of parallels actually dates back to the beginning of a sugar industry trade group called the Sugar Research Foundation, which got its start in the 1940s. And their first scientific director, Robert Hockett, who worked for sugar for about 9 years, actually went on to work for the tobacco industry. So the tobacco industry really got its start with its public relations efforts to try and cast doubt on the links between smoking and cancer in the 1950s. And they hired a public relations firm, Hill & Knowlton, to help them put together their PR strategy and how to work on casting doubt on this evidence. And the Sugar Research Foundation scientific director actually sent a letter to Hill & Knowlton in the 1950s saying, "You guys, look at what I did for sugar and casting doubt on the links between sugar and diabetes and obesity and heart disease. What's going on with the cigarette industry is so similar that you guys really should hire me. You know, I can do the same thing for the tobacco industry." And in fact, they did hire him, and he went on to be their assistant scientific director of their tobacco industry research committee. And even more sugar executives went on to work for tobacco. Another gentleman, John Hickson, went on to work for their cigar industry PR group. So it's more than just similar behavior. It's actually some of the same actors going back and forth between the two industries.
Kristen Kearns is our guest this morning, talking about a new trove of documents at UCSF looking at the food industry. You can join the conversation this morning on The Exchange by calling us at 800-838-3760 or by email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Kristen, you know, when this industry-sponsored research is reported in the media, it plays on people's skepticism, especially with food and health. So many of us have, you know, we've lived through radical changes in policy recommendations. I remember when I was a kid, butter was really bad, and then, you know, you're supposed to eat margarine, and now there's studies that saying that, you know, margarine's actually not very good for you. Butter might be better. Fat was bad, carbs were good, and again, that has changed. So what message do you have for the public who's both, you know, probably fatigued and confused by all this contradictory health advice that just keeps coming at us?
Well, my advice is to be skeptical of a lot of the research that comes out through the media, and I think people need to be aware of the funding of a lot of this research and what agenda that research is out there supporting. And so, you know, it's not just the sugar industry, but the dairy industry, the vegetable oil industry, the meat industry, the refined carbohydrate, you know, even the starch industry. All of these industries have their own trade groups, their own agendas. You know, chocolate, and, you know, chocolate's good for you. You even hear articles coming out related to that. So you really have to look at the source of the funding. And unfortunately, I think oftentimes the media doesn't do a good job of really digging into the source to help readers understand where some of that material is coming from.
So, for example, I'm looking down at my cup of coffee right now. There are studies that have come out saying, hey, you know, drinking coffee is actually good for you. There's some positive health effects there. You know, we might find that that's funded by a trade group. I'm not saying that it is. I'm just using that as a hypothetical.
Yes, I think that's highly likely. And I would recommend Mary Nessel's new book called The Unsavory Truth, where she is exploring just that issue and how many different studies along these lines have been funded by the food industry. And I think it would shock people to know, you know, how many different groups are out there funding studies like this.
Kristen Kearns, this archive is now just becoming available to researchers, and I take it from the material that I've read prior to this interview that you know, even though you found this stuff, you haven't even had the time to go through everything. And it also seems like you want to expand the archive. So what are the next steps for you?
That's right. And so we have our team here at UCSF of researchers trying to get information out about what we know is in the archives, additionally writing more articles. But there is so much material that there's no way that we could ever tackle all of the topics. So we're really excited about the archive coming online, open to anyone, anywhere in the world. We invite everyone to take a look at it. I think, you know, just typing in Coca-Cola could bring up some interesting things. You know, we hope that nonprofit groups, advocacy groups will take a look at it. But as well, we do want to expand it. I mean, we know that there is much more material out there, and it's just a matter of funding for it. You know, if we had more funding, we could be out there collecting more material. So we know there's a lot more to be found. And really, we've just kind of focused our efforts on the U.S., although there is one collection up in Vancouver, BC, and we know there's probably internationally many more sources of material to be found.
Our guest this morning on The Exchange has been Kristen Kearns. She's an assistant professor in dental public health at the University of California, San Francisco. Kristen, thanks for being with us again here on The Exchange.